And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Dave, this last week was a week of rebellion in only about 200 cities in America. 11,000 people arrested, they say. Some unbelievable brutality in some cities by police against protesters, all against the background of continuing coronavirus infection, continuing 40 million people out of work. They say that the unemployment rate dropped by a point or 0.3. But a deeper study showed that there's probably 27% unemployment if you take into account people who usually don't get counted because they're not looking for work because they've been discouraged. So the crisis in the society continues. It intensifies. There are spikes in coronavirus infections in the South and in the West, precisely the places Trump has been demanding open up. And Trump has retreated to the White House bunker. And they've formed a fence, a chain link fence around the White House and a block out from the White House, which resembles, they say, the Green Zone in Baghdad. What a situation.
Yeah. Well, he finally got his wall, but Mexico ain't paying for it.
That's right.
There's just so much. That may be part of the problem is every day there's so many things to deal with. Of course, we go back to Trump's inaugural address about American carnage, and he promised to end it. And what he's done is really created and expanded it. We've got massive deaths in terms of the virus, over 100,000 deaths.
More than any other country in the entire world.
Yeah. Tens of thousands of which could have been avoided, according to evaluations, because of his late inaction. And we've had deaths on the streets. And, you talk about...
And talk about the wealth that's been destroyed, as well as the lives that have been destroyed. And yet his program is kill people to get profits rolling again. And he is successful in killing people, but he can't get the profits rolling again.
Apparently it won't be for want of trying, but Wall Street has come roaring back, which, of course, is the only measure that he sees. And it's a visual measure. You know, people see the Dow Jones numbers picking up and perking up. And that's what he wants. He wants the appearances of things because he's a showman.
Well, because he has no other understanding. He thinks the appearance is the reality. He says if you test, you'll have more cases. So don't test. Then you won't have more cases. If that's not the appearance over reality, nothing is.
Well, they also... they talk about in his briefings and that he can't read things and understand things, that they have to show him simplistic charts and simplistic pictures for him to understand. That's the way his mind functions, such as it is. And I'm reminded...
But don't forget that behind all of that, his administration has been very successful in what they care about, removing regulation, removing environmental regulation, poisoning the economy, delivering tax cuts to the rich. In all of that, he's been very successful.
And they're still doing that on environmental regulations. They're using all of this as a basis for it.
Yep.
And
rewarding every crook, every crook imaginable being rewarded. Betsy DeVos produced a set of regulations for the education department, making sure that the crooks who fund these phony online colleges should be exempt from prosecution, and that the kids and young adults who were conned into spending their money thinking that they were going to get a useful education should still have to pay back the loans, even though it was all fraudulent, because she is an investor in those institutions.
it's too bad for Trump that she wasn't the Secretary of Education when the Trump University
That's right.
Going through.
Yeah.
But I started to say, you know, appearances and visuals. Frank Luntz, the political consultant, the wordsmith, and whatever, is a big advocate. He said pictures are very important. And, you know, getting back to what's been happening, these demonstrations that we've been seeing are being pictured from all sorts of different angles. You know, back in some ways, these are reminiscent of what we saw in the 67, 68, the anti-war demonstrations, or the demonstrations after Martin Luther King was shot, those things. But those were all news footage that were done by, you know, only a couple networks. What we're seeing now is, first of all, a proliferation of news networks. We've got networks from all over the world, the Australians and whatever, but every person in the demonstration, every person watching the demonstration are taking pictures. And that's what people are seeing, and they're being uploaded to social media. They're being sent to the news organizations like CNN, and they're playing out in almost real time, and they're undercutting the story that for want of a better word, the establishment is trying to put out, for instance, on police conduct, or should we say police misconduct. We had that happen in Buffalo the other night, where a 75-year-old man walked up to police. He started to talk to him. We don't know exactly what he said. He looked a little agitated. And two of the officers pushed him back, knocked him over. He hit his head, started bleeding immediately, and they just stepped over him and kept going. And the police department issued a statement saying that the man tripped. You know, that isn't cutting it. And it undercuts the official statements of those who try to cover things up. Certain police departments, you know.
But before you leave Buffalo, then the police chief in Buffalo dismissed the two cops who pushed them over. They were on the special forces unit of the Buffalo police,
right.
Whereupon the 57 other members of the special forces unit of the Buffalo police resigned from the special forces unit of the Buffalo police in solidarity, not with the guy who got hurt, but with the two cops who hurt him.
And who lied about it.
And I'm saying to myself, why don't they just fire these 59 cops? What kind of loyalty can you imagine that these cops have to the community? How could they remotely be considered to so-called serve and protect? They're serving themselves and protecting racism.
That's exactly that was exactly it. The reason they can't be fired probably is because of what we call union contracts. And those contracts are built into, in a lot of places, immunities from prosecution. We have
there's a Supreme Court ruling that gives cops immunity from prosecution. It's
right.
Nearly impossible for a cop not to have immunity, no matter what he did.
Yeah, but they're disciplinary procedures, and they go to arbitrations rather than
nothing ever happens.
Well,
because if something would happen, you wouldn't have these rebellions.
Right. And of course, now what we're seeing is the some things that are happening because people are able to view those things from the viewpoint of people who are not cops, but who are just around these incidents. That's what happened in Minneapolis that set this thing off. And it's happening in a lot of other cities as well. We've seen police brutality in New York City. We've seen it in L.A. There was a picture, I think it was in L.A., of a woman kneeling, covering her eyes, and a cop just comes up and kicks her and knocks her over and steps on her, things like that. And I started to say what they were supposed to do, what they were trying to do, was give police officers cameras, body cameras. And those things had spread, and in a lot of instances, for instance, on traffic stops and whatever, you did see where the police were justified in doing what they were doing. But in the others, you saw just the opposite. And what we found out in many of these cases, either the police don't have body cameras, or they conveniently don't have them turned on, or they get turned off. And there has to be a...
That's what happened in Kentucky.
Yeah, Louisville. And I think there has to be a provision that if you have a body camera and you don't turn it on at the beginning of your shift, or you turn it off during your shift, that there's an automatic suspension, there's an automatic consequence. It might not stop them from turning it off, because what they don't want seen could be worse than just getting a suspension, but there has to be some greater accountability there. And of course, we haven't seen the body cameras of the police, if there were any in Buffalo, or what they showed. We haven't seen the body cameras of the cops in Minneapolis on George Floyd. We've only seen what spectators saw, or what cameras from business establishments in the area show.
And there's something grotesque about the fact that the police response to demonstrations against police brutality is police brutality against the demonstrators demonstrating against police brutality. That's weird, don't you think? Wouldn't you think that in that situation, at least, the cops, the individuals, and their commanders would make sure to do nothing that would undercut their argument, saying, no, we're not brutal, we don't do these things. Instead, they argue, of course we do these things, it's the right way to behave.
Well, this is a cultural issue.
It is a cultural issue.
It's the kind of persons that may be attracted to police, and it's the kind of, and it's what the training officers do and go through. Remember, in Minneapolis, two of the police officers there were trainees of the guy who sat, whose knee was on the neck of George Floyd.
Yeah.
He was their boss, in effect, and showing them this is how it's done, folks. And so we have this endemic thing. But there's,
and it's in the general culture, because who among us doesn't watch cop shows? And the theme of every cop show, I don't care what it is, which it is, the cops violate the rules constantly, and it's always with a wink and a nod, and it's always justified, because after all, the cops are like a nation apart, and they're at war with the enemy, namely the civilians. Every cop show is like that. It's been like that for 40 years, two generations. And everybody soaks in that culture. Of course we have to do that, because the basest instincts of the civilian population has to be crushed, and it can only be crushed by brutal cops. So you look the other way. Men, women, black, white, doesn't matter. That's what the culture has inculcated in everybody.
Law and order.
Yeah.
There still hasn't been anything done, I believe, with that woman who was a police officer that was shot, what, 7 or 8 times in her own apartment, where they broke down the door.
Who died?
Which city? Yeah, she died. Which city that was in. On the other hand, we have seen some measures. We've seen some police officers taking knees. We've seen some police officers marching with the marchers. It may not be enough, but there are some signs of change there. And
maybe, but it's just like asking a common soldier to violate an illegal order. He's not going to do it, and if he did it, he'd be one. The rest of the army would carry out the illegal order. So it's very good where you have an example of a isolated police person here or there who repudiates the general racism and authoritarianism of the police force. But the fact of the matter is, it's a general cultural and policy line of police. It's got to be a wholesale change in the policing institutions in the entire country, which is not so simple, since it's all local.
Yeah. One other thing, though, that I want to point out is different than the 60s. In the 60s, when you had riots and rioters, the public wasn't all with the protesters. In this situation, it tends to look like a lot of the public is with the protesters, which is why we're seeing so many other protests in so many other cities nationwide and around the world. And again, I think that gets back to the visuals that people can see for themselves.
But we even had protests right around in our region, in Wilkes-Barre, Honesdale, Scranton, Williamsport. Yeah. I mean, that's very unusual.
Yeah, they didn't make big news, but Honesdale had a huge rally. There was some trepidation. There were reports that there was going to be an anti-rally and whatever. And in fact, I saw a snippet on the news of a bunch of guys in pickup trucks going by the rally, you know, sort of cursing them out. And of course, one of those pickup trucks had a big Confederate flag on the back of it.
At least they knew what side they were on.
Yeah. Scranton, I mean, Honesdale had about 500 people, which is huge for a small county like that. Scranton, late in the week, had a rally of about 200 people. There were all sorts of rumors floating around that there was going to be disturbances and fighting and whatever. That never took place. That never took place. It was a peaceful march. It was a different kind of march. We didn't see the too many of the establishment figures in, or the people from the old school of civil demonstrators leading it. It seemed to be a younger group, a more female group out there leading it. But they kept it. I think smartly kept it within without creating any undue problems.
Were these the same women who marched against Trump in the women demonstrations right after the election of 2016?
There may have been some, but I don't think the leadership was the same. Mm-hmm. We weren't getting any emails from the progressive women's group saying meet there. You didn't get anything from Move On or whatever.
So this is very interesting. The progressive electorally oriented groups, these are not the groups that are involved in this rebellion, at least not in our area.
They may be sympathetic to them, but they haven't.
But they're not playing a role. They're not playing a leadership role.
Yeah, they're not playing that I can see.
Well, this is very interesting because it really shows that this is a non-electoral coalition that's taken to the streets. The very people that the people interested in involving non-voters in voting think that they have a chance of involving in voting.
You know, one thing about the Trump folks, his political machinery, is they've gone out of their way that whenever they had rallies to take names and contact information, they built up a huge index of these people and are going to work to try out. That's why they still think they can win this election. They have supposedly over 110 million names out there, and they think if they get 70 million of them out, they're going to win. I think this has been a lost opportunity for the people and the Democrats. They should have been at these rallies taking names and trying to make sure that their contact information to follow up and getting voter registration going.
Meanwhile, aside from the disarray among the Democrats, there's increasing disarray in the Trump camp. I mean, he didn't have a good week. Forget the rebellion. His own inner circle is crumbling. And he has to take to the bunker. He had to go hide.
Well, he said he just made an inspection late at night down five floors and after they turned out the lights. I mean,
exactly.
He tried, again, we get back to the visuals. He tried to have a photo op and it backfired on him. He hastily called a news conference on Friday to trump up what he called good economic news, that the unemployment rate was only 13.3%. And I want to comment on that in a second. His verbiage was incredible. He invoked the name of George Floyd, saying he's looking down on us and thinking, what a great day for America. I mean, that's about as repugnant a statement as one can make when one talks about it. And then when he had this press conference, he wasn't taking any questions about that or other things. there's one other thing that I, you know,
that, well, you
that
think that
me.
A press conference, the press should ask questions. Obviously, you don't understand the role of the press.
Well, I do understand the role of the press. And that's what I want to say. In this case, I was very disappointed in the press. Not that they weren't trying to ask questions. The coverage of it or whatever, and I mean, he just used it as a for his own purposes. But before the conference, this was done on the lawn out at the White House. I'm not sure which area. The seats had been set up with social distancing.
6 feet apart.
6 feet apart. And before the conference, the staff came over and they put all the seats together. And they told the reporters said, why are you doing this? We're supposed to social distance. Those are your rules. And they said, well, it makes it easier or makes it look better or whatever.
No, they said it makes it look better, right.
Yeah, and then I saw the picture from the back of all the reporters sitting in these crowded things, and I'm thinking, why the hell didn't the reporters pick up their folding chairs and move them?
That's right.
What kind of fools were they?
That's right.
You know, they moved them to make you more in danger of spreading disease, and you sat there like patsies? The best statement you could have made was everybody pick up your chair and move it back to where the heck it was. And if Trump didn't like it, then we're not going to have a press conference.
It wasn't a press conference anyway. He was just making.
I understand.
Yeah.
I understand. But what were they going to do if the press moved it back?
The press shouldn't be going to these things anyhow. If he doesn't answer questions, what's the point of being there?
The problem is that they don't know whether he's going to answer questions until they.
Well, but you know that he's going to lie because that's what he does. So why go?
Yeah.
Why go?
I mean,
I.F. Stone used to say, never go to a press conference because they just lie. Go read the papers instead. Go read the documents in the background instead. Then you might find out the truth.
That was Izzy Stone. Trump, they try to ask him a question on Fox where he will, you know, appear by phone, and Brian Kilmeade ask him a question, and his answer was absolutely incomprehensible. It was just like they call it word salad. You can't describe it in any other way. Repugnant doesn't do it. It was just his basic thing: just talk and talk and talk, whatever. And things are kind of falling apart there.
Yeah, and meanwhile, all the generals that he boasted about, the greatest general in the world, the greatest general in history, the greatest, they all turned against him openly this last week.
Yeah.
Right? Mattis issued a written statement condemning him. Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, condemned him. Allen condemned him. Kelly, his former chief of staff, condemned him. I mean, it's a rare week in American history when that kind of thing happens.
You know, Mattis came out and called it 3 years of immature leadership. But you wonder where these guys were all along. You know, Kelly took the job knowing that Trump had dissed a Gold Star family, knowing that he had dissed John McCain's service and his heroism and all these things, and they'd gone along with it. Milley's remarks, I think, were maybe most telling because what he simply said to all the leaders of all, he's the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, all the branches was, folks, remember, our oath is to the Constitution. And that's an important thing. I think he's looking down the road where people are saying if Trump loses, he doesn't want to leave. And the Constitution mandates that he leave. So we'll see what happens there.
Well, don't forget that Jared said that he's not sure that they can hold an election. He's not ready to say that they'll be able to hold the election.
Yeah, do the words martial law begin to take over? But we did have election this week here in Pennsylvania that we need to talk about.
And we had, 1,300,000 mail-in ballots?
For
just
Democrat.
On the Democrats. And another half a million or so on the Republican side.
Right. And there were some interesting results. Biden won. Came within a hair's width of clinching the nomination, but then later in the week he did when Guam held its election and put him over. So at the convention, you know,
how many votes do you think he got in Guam?
I don't know. I remember Bernie won.
My question is that I was just curious whether you got more votes in Pennsylvania than Biden got in Guam. because you got a lot of votes in Pennsylvania. You were running for delegate.
I was running for alternate delegate. I'm sure I got more. I'm sure I got more.
You outpolled Biden.
I am. Yeah, and I'm a lot younger to run for president.
There
right?
you go. That's right.
And I'm still in Scranton. Didn't
right.
move out.
Exactly.
Yeah, but we saw that. The bigger race around here was the 8th Congressional District race, which is one that the Republicans have been targeting against Matt Cartwright, our four-term congressman. And it was a six-man field. And a guy named Jim Bognut, who had spent most of the most money on advertising and attacked his opponents, came out the winner. It wasn't an easy win. A former combat vet named Terry Daniels, who was a real pro-Trumper, came in second, surprisingly second. And it was a close second. And then Earl Granville, who had been designated by Mark McCarthy to be the nominee, came in third. He was the only Lackawanna County guy in the race. The interesting thing is Cartwright had a very strong showing. He had 76,000 total votes, and his Republicans, the six rivals, only tallied about 56,000 votes, which doesn't bode well for those who think that they're going to be able to beat Cartwright in the fall.
And Cartwright was someone that the Republican National Committee months ago thought about as a easy pushover and a seat that they could pick up.
Well, Trump was a +10 Trump district.
Yeah.
And he and Connor Lamb were the two targets in Pennsylvania, flipped from blue to red. And it doesn't look like that's going to happen now. It shouldn't happen. We'll have to see. Bognut made a lot of enemies in this thing. There were a couple of other people in, Steve King got beat. The Republicans turned against him in Iowa. That's bad for the Democrats. It's good for the Republicans. But
it's good for the country to get King out of there. You shouldn't have open segregationists and Nazi sympathizers in the Congress.
The guy that said what's wrong with being, pro-white or something like that. Yeah. Valerie Plame got beat in New Mexico. She was running for a seat.
She ran an inept campaign.
Yeah, she wasn't a campaigner. And she, in a Hispanic area, she ran against a Hispanic, so she didn't have that background. And she's fairly new to New Mexico. Ferguson, Missouri.
And she circulated an article, which was an anti-Semitic article, and then she later said, well, she didn't really read it.
Right.
Well, that doesn't bode. I mean, she's an intelligence person. What do you mean you didn't read it?
Yeah. Yeah. And Ferguson, Missouri elected a black woman, which will be interesting to see how that happens. And, of course, talking about people that did things that weren't not only politically correct, but distasteful. Dalen Leach, the state senator, maybe the most liberal state senator, but who's been accused by many women of inappropriate actions and harassment, refused to resign even at the request of the governor. He got beat in his primary. So that's an interesting one there. One other thing we should note, that in Philadelphia, the statue of former Mayor Frank Rizzo, former police commissioner, police officer Frank Rizzo, who was a hero in South Philadelphia, they took that down. It had been defaced by the rioters, and they took that down.
But Rizzo, everybody who's not from Philly should know, is a symbol in Pennsylvania of white racism.
Yeah.
That's how he made his reputation.
Yeah, and they're finally apparently going to take down the statue of Robert E. Lee in Richmond, Virginia. The governor made that decision. Of course, the governor doesn't have to run again. It's only a one-term governorship there.
Yeah. All right, we have filled with rebellions and these continuing rebellions, filled with continuing virus infections. It'll be an interesting week.
And we should note that this was the anniversary of both Tiananmen Square and D-Day. Heroic acts by in Tiananmen Square, an individual, and at D-Day, thousands of Americans who sought to end fascism.
Right.
And we'd probably be appalled at what's happening in America right now.
Well, we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place. This program is supported by Argosy Bookshop of New York City. 116 East 59th Street, just down the block from Bloomingdale's. Old and rare books, prints and maps, members of the International League of Antiquarian Booksellers, founding members of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, members of the Appraisers Association of America, on the web at Argosy Books, ArgosyBooks.com. Check them out for books, autographs, maps, and prints.